and welcome to this episode of the Newcastle Oral History Unit podcast. Throughout this series, we will broadcast regular episodes that feature some of the fantastic interviews that we have conducted over the last couple of years. Episodes will range from project-specific discussions to conversations with leading international oral historians about their own practice and future directions within the field. Please feel free to contact us at any time via email, where we're at oralhistory@newcastle.ac.uk, or follow us on Twitter, where we're at @NCL_oralhistory. My name is Andy Clark, and on this episode I'm going to talk about the first project that I undertook when I joined the unit back in 2017. It focused on the wartime apprenticeship scheme at the Sigmund Pumps Factory in Gateshead. I interviewed five apprentices who completed their engineering training during World War II, seeking to understand how the apprenticeship scheme is remembered in the context of working lives and the apparent success of the scheme in training apprentices. I hope you enjoy. Sigmund Pumps was established in the modern-day Czech Republic by Ludwig Sigmund in 1868. By the 1930s, the firm was run by his three grandsons, including Miroslav, who had a degree in mechanical and electrical engineering. At this time, the three Sigmund brothers recognised the growing threat of Nazi invasion and sought to protect the firm and its assets. Miroslav, the firm's exports manager, toured the former Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, France and the UK in seeking a location to move the company and its machinery. Within Britain, Miroslav found a suitable market gap and also the ideal base for his operation, the Team Valley Trading Estate in Gateshead. The Team Valley Estate represents one of the first significant interventions by the British government in promoting regional economic growth. The Great Depression had disproportionately impacted areas with a reliance on heavy industry. The northeast of England was dominated by shipbuilding and coal mining and became synonymous with the unemployment and poverty of the period through the Jarrow Crusade to London in October 1936. The regional differences in the impacts of depression were outlined in the Times of London in March 1934, when they wrote that there are parts of County Durham where one feels strongly, sometimes angrily, that London still has no conception of the troubles that affect the industrial north. The dire economic situation in regions like the North East led to three Special Areas Acts, with commissioners appointed to assess and advise. The Commissioner for the North East, Ewan Wallace MP, stated bluntly that Durham and Tyneside could only escape unemployment and depression by means of external assistance. Traditional laissez-faire government would not suffice. In response, the Team Valley Estate was established in 1937, becoming the first government-funded industrial estate in the UK. The purpose was to diversify manufacturing in the region away from heavy industry and to promote light engineering. The environment was to be more pleasant than the yards, mines and foundries of the area. The commission said that Team Valley would have open spaces, playing fields, canteens and other amenities in order to create a healthy and pleasant condition. This environment was ideal for Sigmund, and Sigmund Pumps, Great Britain, was incorporated in August 1937. His brother Jan began the process of shipping tools to the UK, and he continued to do so after the German invasion. Jan was subsequently arrested by the Gestapo in October 1940 and was shot 18 months later. Impending war with Nazi Germany was also key to Sigmund setting up in Britain. The government established an emergency fund for the production of civil defence items to resist the Blitzkrieg. One product urgently required was an efficient firefighting water pump that would be given out to every household across the country.
Today, pumps are in the news. You know, the kind of pumps for spraying on incendiary bombs. And here they are in the making, and in the foundry, for it's there that molten brass ingots are poured into moulds for the castings. In the machine shop, the brass tube is cut into length and given a thread for screwing. The tubing is polished, or buffed as they call it, until it gleams like a spring morning. The assembling is started by soldering together the machine parts to make liquid tight joints. There's nothing like a tight joint if you're in a tight spot, and every section fits into place as accurately as the delicate mechanism of a watch. The final assembling, ready for the test. After the stirrup handle, the hose completes the job. The handy hand pump can produce a fine spray or a powerful jet to deal with any emergency. All hands to the pump!
Sigmund was awarded the government contract for stirrup pumps. Due to the urgency of the situation, the contract contained what has been described as impossible delivery dates and subject to heavy penalties for non-fulfilment. The factory had to be operational and producing 1,000 pumps within 28 weeks, and they would be penalised by 1% per pump per week, and ultimately the cancellation of the contract without payment. Despite the need to be fully operational in a remarkably short period of time, Sigmund immediately established a similar apprenticeship scheme to that which had been successful in Czechoslovakia. He believed that the long-term success of the firm would be dependent on training a new generation of engineers beyond the immediacy of the government-ordered contracts. The Sigmund's apprenticeship scheme was interesting for its time, which is where the impetus for this labour oral history project emerged. Apprentices were paid rather than their parents paying the firm. They received free meals throughout the working day. They were not productive for the first year of work, instead being based on a designated apprentice school. They were not apprenticed for a specific trade, but given a rounded engineering education before specialising towards the end of their training. The particularities of the scheme have been celebrated through a number of apprentice reunions and press reports, and also at the time was being analysed by the government ministers to possibly shape future training policies. The first aim of the oral history interviews was to ascertain whether the respondents remembered the apprenticeship as being particularly different from other schemes offered at the time. In this first section, George Lobel, a German Jewish refugee, talks about his recollections of beginning the apprenticeship with the Sigmund pumps.
And of course, the other thing was that A, there was the war was on. You know, this I'm now talking about January 40, and the war started in September 39. And so I was an enemy alien. I was a German, and I couldn't speak English very well because I'd only been in the country about 9 months by then. So it was a great opportunity. Quite apart from the fact, of course, that this was a proper apprenticeship. You were old family who worked in the shipyards will tell you that when they first went into a shipyard, they were gophers. You know, they had to fetch some people's cigarettes. They had to make their tea. They had to fetch their oil, you know, from the stores and this sort of thing. Sigmund was none of that. Firstly, you didn't have to pay for the apprenticeship. The parents didn't have to pay for the apprenticeship. And secondly, of course, it was this what is now become known as off the job. I don't know what they called it in those days, certainly not off the job. It was an apprentice school. It was really a school. We had a tutor and we were taught to do things and we had to do things, certain things. We had a monthly test, you know, a test piece. And It was very attractive in every way.
Bob Crow originally wanted to go to Ray Rolls to serve his apprenticeship, but changed his mind when he heard about the Sigmund scheme, which he believes made a big difference to his education.
Originally, I wanted to go to Ray Rolls,
right,
to become an electrical fitter. I'm glad that I didn't go there, that I went to the other place, Sigmund's. Because Ray Rolls, you would just put on the assembly line, and you, whether you got any progress from just assembling bits and pieces on the assembly line. So when I went to Sigmund's, the correct decision. Because there they taught you how to use all the tools in the school itself.
Yeah.
And then, I forget how long it was, I don't know if it was 9 months or something, you had to be in there. Then you went into the main factory and you went to different sections.
Bill Herbert also stressed the modernity of the scheme and also reflected on the education that the engineers received through the link between Sigmund and the new Gateshead Technical College.
So then I started in the apprentice school. And honestly, looking back, it's a thing that was never around in my day at all. No. People, when I was talking to the people, apprentice school, I said, yes. But because we used to, this is the other interesting thing. They taught us the basics of fitting and turning. You had a lecturer for different types. When a man was ill, or night shift or whatever, you were sometimes sent to the machine shop or fitting shop to learn. Then he came back. On top of that, you got a free dinner, you got free tea, coffee in the morning and in the afternoon, and a keep fit man came once a week and run us along the trading estate. So I mean, how more modern can you get? At the same time, Gateshead Council were building a new college, became Gateshead Technical College. So we were one of the first students in there, and I became second in the Students' Union. So there we go.
A comparison with other apprenticeship schemes at the time is also made possible, as some of the respondents did go elsewhere during their training. At the end of the war and with the winding out of defence contracts, Sigmund's was in severe financial distress, meaning that a number of newer apprentices were assigned to other firms to complete their training. This was a case for Bill, who would go on to work in heavy industry firms at Clark Chapman's and Vickers Armstrong.
What was Sigmund's like to work in? How do you reflect on that?
Compared to where we went to, it was a dream. It was a modern factory.
Yeah, and what kind of ways? What were the main differences?
In
what ways was it a dream? And what ways was it more
you're
modern?
Already seen, Vickers Armstrong, which is a big old-fashioned company, and that was a heavy engineering place. But there's, your company was split into four parts. There was two parts near here and two parts up there, plus a separate tool shop, which had an explosion, of course. But the conditions were really first class. They really were. I mean, clean, tidy, light industry, and, I had nothing to complain about there. Mm.
Through these excerpts, it is clear that the interviewees reflect on the scheme as being progressive, modern, and offering a good route into the engineering trade. There are caveats that must be acknowledged. All of the interviewees participated in apprentice reunions and therefore had some affinity to the scheme and to the firm. Nonetheless, all of them did go on to leave Sigmund's and work for other companies, so weren't necessarily company men. Rather, they reflect on the training programme at the factory as being crucial in laying the foundations for the successful engineering careers that they did have. Bob Crowe stressed the significance of being able to learn a variety of trades and his future career working in the City Council's planning department.
It was the most important thing because I didn't end up just being a fitter working on pieces of the shipyard and whatnot.
Yeah.
It advanced me in as much that I ended up being moved around the factory and they must have been seeing something they'd appreciated rather than just being a fitter. You go in the planning department. So I was in the planning department for umpteen years. It was a cushier number being in the office rather than oily blue overalls and whatnot.
Aye.
So it was a case of quality of life that started me off in having to go to classes and learn about mathematics and from Churchill's, from Sigmund's.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good take-off point. Because I would have probably just ended up in a shipyard working somewhere as a fitter.
Given the importance ascribed to the Sigmund scheme in our first interview sessions, I wanted to use follow-up interviews to ask how they viewed the broader significance of the apprenticeship as a training scheme for engineers. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the interviewees believe that apprenticeships should be an important route into the trade. Interestingly, this is consistently framed through their experiences in Sigmund's. George Lobel makes direct links between recent initiatives in Gateshead College back to the approach of Sigmund during World War II.
I think the main thing is that it was, the forerunner of apprenticeships. I mean, there aren't enough now, of course, except that Gateshead College is very keen on apprenticeships, as I am, and they are working on it. And 2 years ago, they got 1,000. They had 1,000 apprenticeships in this area because they've got industrialists on the board and they're helping them, you see.
Yeah.
The old system of, the local education authority and somebody else, they didn't work together.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Sigmund virtually started that because he said, the LEA, you don't have the money for a lathe, I'll give you one, but I want my apprentices trained.
Tom Cook similarly links his experience of apprenticeships with contemporary skills development for engineers. In this clip, he begins by talking specifically about the Sigmund scheme, but relates this to the skills that can be acquired through vocational training.
Because you've always got a fair proportion of people near retirement age in a number of firms. And of course, the idea, I think, possibly put up a good case for the fact that also we could put in apprentices here, But of course, I think maybe someone held sort of a controlling interest here, in so much as, right, if we do this and you want apprentices, you've got to give them a good sort of give them a good training and such like, mm-hmm. and make sure of this. And I think Sigmund rose to that occasion, because prior to that, apprentices were taken on for cheap, basically cheap labour. But eventually, I mean, they started to make money and such like, and it wasn't so cheap and such. But of course, they were then very valuable in any cases as engineering workers and such like, you see, like, you know, that on the Clyde and that. Mm-hmm. But having said that, I think the apprentices, certainly, they realised that apprentices could really make a very good contribution, because a 14 or a 16-year-old lad is 17 or 18 in a year or two's time. And they've learned, if they are given decent sort of training, they can be a good unit of work, sort of style, mm-hmm. And with particular skills.
In this final clip, Bill Herbert also discusses how he is thankful for the scheme that he had, and attributes this to the way his career developed. We then have a discussion about why he thinks apprenticeships could still be important, which he discusses in reference to newly qualified engineers that he worked alongside throughout his career. Apologies, folks, for the interference in this clip. All of us who have worked with clip mics will be familiar with the rustle that you hear.
And I couldn't speak to any of them. Mm-hmm. That's where I got my incentive to push on.
Yeah.
I was encouraged by them. Mm-hmm. I couldn't thank them enough.
What do you think? Do you think that apprentices now, do you think they're still important? Do they still have a role for young people? Oh,
well, I do. And I don't know much about it now, because I don't know what happened. I really don't, politically. Someone said that Thatcher was to blame for this. I can't honestly say that. But I knew apprenticeships were not sort of as common as what we were apprentices. And I'd asked a few times, where were we going to get new talent from? But this wasn't getting developed. I don't know why. But nowadays, it's starting again. There's a big loss in engineering side. And now a lot of lads and girls are going to college and getting degrees in engineering. But the snag about that is, they haven't had the training that we have seen. They can come into you, quite intelligent, good degrees, but they haven't handled tools and saws in the cut. Mm. Because I've had a few under my wing to bring on. And good luck to them.
Yeah.
But there's a big difference. But now that some of the apprentices are only doing 3 years. We did 5 to become a draftsman. Mm-hmm. Then you did to 25 to become a senior draftsman. Then you had to wait till 30. And he became a design engineer.
Aye.
And that's when he got top money. So you see, it was quite a long haul in the development side.
Although only a small number of in-depth life history interviews were completed, there are some important issues that are raised when analysing these narratives that have both historical and contemporary significance. For decades, apprenticeships in Britain have been viewed as a poor second choice for those who don't get a university education. In 2014, Terry Hyland argued that government attempts at reform over the last 50 years have amounted to inept tinkerings with stale and recycled ideas, which have failed to solve the central problems of apprentice training. The UK government's modern apprenticeship scheme has been labelled by some critics as government subsidy for cheap labour, with little consideration for long-term career development. Perhaps as a result of the poor status of apprenticeships over a sustained period, it was revealed in January 2020 that millions of pounds have been spent by the government on fake apprenticeship schemes. Analysis by the Education and Skills Research Group highlighted that government funds have been used to pay existing staff rather than for training apprentices, with one example including apprentice university lecturers for which a PhD is required. I would argue that this evidence demonstrates that there are several flaws in the training of apprentices, and that a historical approach, utilising the narratives of people like the Sigmund's engineers, should play a key role in informing future legislation. I'm currently working with the Common Room of the Great North, formerly the Newcastle Mining Institute, to interview current and recently completed engineering apprentices. I hope that by collecting in-depth interviews with workers since World War II will illuminate the reasons why some apprenticeship schemes have been successful through examining their significance within narratives of working lives and the occupational identities of former and current workers. This has been a podcast from the Newcastle Oral History Unit. Thanks for listening. We hope you've enjoyed it. And remember, you can contact us via email at oralhistory@newcastle.ac.uk and follow us on Twitter. We're at oralhistory_NCL.